It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let's join in an attitude of prayer. Let us not make life any harder than it is by pretending that its meaning lies hidden in some faraway secret place, or that life's secrets are heavily guarded and we can't know how to live without them. Nothing is hidden. It's just not being sought. The fact that love is better than hate is not a secret, nor that people of good character are called, commanded, to follow a loving path here, everywhere. And the fact that we are as precious as the next person means the next person is as precious as us. This simple fact has implications for how we must treat one another and how we must live at home and abroad. It is not a secret that truth must trump deceit, or that justice must play the tune to which all decent people want to learn how to dance. These things may be rare, they may be hard, but they are not hidden, not secret. The truth that can set us free is that everything we need is within and around us, hovering between us as a magical force field, inviting us to touch its energy and to be touched and transformed by it. Life has many real problems we must solve: what to do for a living, how and where to work, what gifts we must offer to make a connection with our world. But the bigger questions of whether we are worthwhile and how we should treat one another, here nothing is hidden. Here we stand like all others, needing to give and receive love, needing someone to need our gifts, needing to learn how to recognize and cherish the gifts being offered to us from those whose love we cherish. Here nothing is hidden. Nothing is hidden at all. Let us learn to live in this land without secrets, and let us learn to live with one another. For we are all children of God, the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. And we need one another. Amen. A lot of times sermons are like treasure hunts. We look through religious writings for the few things worth bringing home, the gold nuggets that are scattered around in the lesser stuff. Since we can always find some nuggets if we look well, preachers feel confident that their religion, whatever it is really a gold mine. And of course they're right that every religion has served, among other things, as a magnet that draws together some wisdom and some kindness to pass on. But the truth is that you don't have to go to religious traditions for this wisdom or for these nuggets. They're everywhere, if only we'll look for them. Now, on the one hand, that's a good thing, because nearly 80% of Americans don't go to church regularly. On the other hand, this hunt for gold nuggets still requires that we know how to look and that we're looking for the right things. It's a very different experience looking through the thousands of proverbs and sayings and quotations that I've been looking through this week than looking through religious scriptures. It feels very different reading these things. One of the things you find is that in folk sayings and secular parables and so on, there's a widespread distrust of religion, churches, and ministers. And it's not hidden. Benjamin Franklin said that lighthouses are more helpful than churches. That's a pretty pregnant one, isn't it? A German proverb says that in the visible church, the true Christians are invisible. And a French proverb echoes this when it says, "He who is near the church is often far from God." The French also observe that many come to church to air their finery. Okay, not here. God doesn't fare very well either in these writings. A century and a half ago, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote that the God of the cannibals will be a cannibal, of the crusaders will be a crusader, of the merchants will be a merchant. But more than 2,000 years before him, the Greek Xenophanes had observed from his own travels that black people create black gods, while the gods of red-haired people have red hair, and blondes create gods in their own image just like everyone else. Now, if neither churches nor gods fare well in the public arena, neither do preachers. Germans say, "There are many preachers who don't hear themselves." Now that's kind. The Yiddish take the gloves off when they say it was hard for Satan alone to mislead the world, so he created rabbis. And even religion itself is often seen as a bad thing in common folklore. More than 2,000 years ago, the Roman Lucretius wrote with much disgust about the evil deeds that religion could prompt. More recently, the New York Times quoted a modern Lucretius, saying that with or without religion, you'd have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. And while I've spent several years reading many theology books on the way to getting a degree in theology, I still love the predictable wit of the American critic of pretty much everything, H.L. Mencken, when he wrote that for centuries now, theologians have been explaining the unknowable in terms of the not worth knowing. Today, on this day between holidays, I have decided to do something that I've never done for a sermon before. As you may already have gathered, I'm not going to be looking through religious scriptures this morning. Instead, I've gone treasure hunting through a few thousand non-religious bits of wisdom of the kind of common sense you find in proverbs and sayings from all over the world. I'm not hunting randomly. I'm looking for the same kinds of things that I look for when I look through religious scriptures. I'm looking for someone's insight into who we are and where we are and what the human condition is and what's wrong and what we need to do about it and how to live a life we'll be glad to have lived. But you find that common proverbs and sayings are just as concerned with this as religious writings are. Here are some sayings. I'm not going to give footnotes for all these. If you want footnotes, you can get the version that'll be online. I'll mention a few, but here are some sayings I suspect we'd all agree on from a wide range of sources. Each day provides its own gifts. Noble and common blood
is of the same color. Good advice is often annoying. Bad advice, never. And as scarce as truth is, the supply has always been excess of the demand. We would resonate with the Latin proverb, live your own life, for you'll die your own death. So it isn't quite clear how to do that yet. But we would agree with Abigail Van Buren, dear Abby, when she said that the best index to a person's character is how he treats people who can't do him any good and how he treats people who can't fight back. By this standard, our country doesn't look good right now, anywhere. I read sayings like, what lies behind us and what lies before us are small matters compared to what lies within us. Or, it's faith in something and enthusiasm for something that makes a life worth living. And I think that's right. That's right. And I think we'd all agree with Thomas Jefferson when he writes that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few born to ride them. Ralph Waldo Emerson can still make us uncomfortable when he writes, whatever games are played with us, we must play no games with ourselves. We know he's right. Surely Abraham Lincoln was right too when he said that most folks are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. And it's worth writing down Gandhi's formula. Happiness, he says, is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. Then we read a line like, as a well-spent day brings happy sleep, so life well used brings a happy death. And you think, that Leonardo da Vinci could think as well as he could draw, paint, and sculpt. We might not agree with American comedian George Burns when he says that happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city. Or we might agree. But surely the great Frenchman Victor Hugo nailed it when he said that life's greatest happiness is to be convinced that we are loved. And we dearly hope, and we usually believe, with the 19th century Unitarian minister, William Ellery Channing, that every human being has a work to carry on within, duties to perform abroad, influence to exert, which are peculiarly his and which no conscience but his own can teach. That's ennobling. And what role does our character play in our happiness? A modern philosopher says our character is an omen of our destiny. And the more integrity we have and keep, the simpler and nobler that destiny is likely to be. And there he echoes the ancient Greek Heraclitus, who 2,500 years earlier said the same thing in just three words. Character is destiny. We might not agree with Emerson when he says, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. But when he says, make the most of yourself, for that's all there is of you, we want to write it down. Unless you prefer the shorter version by the 20th century rock philosopher Janis Joplin. Don't compromise yourself, you're all you've got. The Vietnamese Buddhist, Thich Nhat Hanh, is a lovely few lines. He says, people usually consider walking on water or in thin air a miracle. But the real miracle is not to walk either on water or in thin air, but to walk on earth. Every day we are engaged in a miracle which we don't even recognize. A blue sky, white clouds, green leaves, the black, curious eyes of a child, our own two eyes. All is a miracle. We read this, and we're glad that he raised the discussion up a level or two. But it isn't enough to sit and admire ourselves or stare at the world all moon-faced for very long. We'll bore everyone to sleep in about 5 minutes. What we really need is not a tensionless state, but rather the striving and struggling for some goal worthy of us. What we need is not the discharge of tension at any cost, but the call of a potential meaning waiting to be fulfilled by us. That was Viktor Frankl, who'd lived through Auschwitz. Albert Einstein, like Da Vinci, grows far beyond his own realm of sciences when he says, "Try not to become a man of success, rather try to become a man of value." How do we do that? Psychotherapist Viktor Frankl says, if architects want to strengthen a decrepit arch, they increase the load that's laid upon it, for thereby the parts are joined more firmly together. So if therapists wish to foster their patients' mental health, they shouldn't be afraid to increase that load through a reorientation toward the meaning of one's life. That's pure religion. And the late movie actor, Christopher Reeve, wrapped it in poetic language when he said, "I think we all have a little voice inside us that will guide us. It may be God, I don't know. But I think that if we shut out all the noise and clutter from our lives and listen to that voice, that it will tell us the right thing to do." So far, we can find about as much relevant wisdom from proverbs and sayings as we can in religious scriptures. But somewhere around here, just as we're getting this list of happy face, positive things that make it all seem so simple, somewhere around here fear enters. Or as one woman put it, "Now comes a sobering thought. What if at this very moment I am living up to my full potential?" You can't talk about idealistic pictures of life in any language without talking about fear. It's well known that the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes thought that fear of the unknown was the source of every religion. And even if we won't go that far, we would agree with the Swedish proverb that fear gives a small thing a big shadow. Or fear is that little dark room where negatives are developed. Fear costs a lot on both individual and national levels. For as Edward R. Murrow once said, a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. Some have even said that there are basically just two kinds of people, those who are alive and those who are afraid. And the truth is that only when we are no longer afraid do we really begin to live. And then we're reminded that Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent. Never give it." Just like religious teachings, the best secular sayings lead past fear toward hope. We can't lose hope, for if you lose hope, somehow you lose the vitality that keeps life moving, said Martin Luther King. You lose that courage to be, that quality that helps you go on in spite of it all. We must not lose faith in humanity, Gandhi said. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean doesn't become dirty. But for here, the last words on fear I'll take from New Age guru Marianne Williamson, from a paragraph that's been quoted many times and is well thought, well felt, and well crafted. Our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond measure. It's our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightening about shrinking so that other people won't feel unsure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that's within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. As we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Wonderful. What possibilities beckon from beyond fear? There seem to be two main categories. One is the possibility of loving, which can itself dispel fear. The comedian Lucille Ball once said, I have an everyday religion that works for me. Love yourself first and everything else falls into line. Not bad. She's in good company. She's joined by the great Russian novelist Dostoevsky, who took it much farther. Love the animals, he said. Love the plants. Love everything. If you love everything, you will perceive the divine mystery in things. Once you perceive it, you'll begin to comprehend it better every day. And you will come at last to love the whole world with an all-embracing love. Some would just call this a religious awakening. But according to a Quaker writer, a religious awakening which does not awaken the sleeper to love has roused her in vain. So, one answer that lies beyond fear and can lead beyond fear is love. And many have found it the secret of life. For others, it's not just love, but love turned into service. That's the secret of a life they're glad to have lived. They say things like, service is what life is all about. Service is the rent we pay to be living. It's the very purpose of life, not something you do in your spare time. And that only a life lived for others is a life worthwhile. How contrary that is to the message of our culture today, or of almost any culture in almost any day. Albert Schweitzer said, I don't know what your destiny will be, but one thing I do know. The only ones among you who will be really happy are those who have sought and found how to serve. Somewhere along here, even though I'm just using secular writers, we come to the question of faith, of what we shall or should believe. The psychotherapist Carl Jung once famously wrote that among all my patients in the second half of life, there's not been one whose problem in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. But when these people say religious, they're not talking like priests. They don't mean to defend orthodoxy or any recognized religion. They mean something deeper. The French writer Anne Nin says, when we blindly adopt a religion, a political system, a literary dogma, we become automatons and we cease to grow. She would have found a wonderful companion in Thomas Jefferson. For he said we should question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. And it's in our lives, not our words, that our religion must be read. Now, this doesn't mean that their religion was atheism. Calling atheism a religion is like calling bald a hair color. But it does mean that their religion colors far outside the lines, that it's a profoundly liberal place to stand, drawing from anywhere they find healthy wisdom. Ralph Waldo Emerson said to make your own Bible. He said, select and collect all the words and sentences that in your reading have been like the blast of triumph out of Shakespeare, Seneca, Moses, John, Paul, the rest of them. And Thomas Jefferson did make his own Bible. He went to the original Latin and Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, threw out everything that smacked of superstition, and put together a much smaller book consisting only of the ethical teachings of Jesus, which he felt were all the teachings one needed to live a full life. Now, see if you don't like this short definition of religion, and if you might guess where it would have come from. This is my simple religion. There's no need for temples, no need for complicated philosophy. Our own brain, our own heart is our temple. The philosophy is kindness, period. This may sound like Carl Sagan, but it's actually His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Religion's a fairly simple thing for these people. What you're finding is a universal kind of religion among the best of people, people of the best minds and the best hearts. Lincoln said, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. It sounds like Emerson, who said, religion is to do right, it's to love, it's to serve, it's to think, it's to be humble. Or Einstein, for whom true religion is real living, living with all one's soul, with all one's goodness and righteousness. And these aren't new ideas. The ancient Roman Marcus Aurelius' advice for living was even shorter. If it's not right, don't do it. If it's not true, don't say it. Eventually, all faith has to be turned to some kind of action that can direct our life. Because washing one's hands of the conflict between the powerful and the powerless means that you are siding with the powerful, not being neutral. You can put this in one short sentence. Those who say religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion is. Those aren't my words. They're Gandhi's. Now, a few of these thoughtful secular people wrote more about the faith that gave their lives meaning, and some of these are worth sharing here. The socialist Eugene V. Debs, an early 20th century champion of workers' rights, wrote this. Years ago, I recognized my kinship with all living things, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on the earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. While there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free. And Bertrand Russell, perhaps one of the least friendly voices toward religion, wrote one of the more poetic religious statements of faith that I've read. He was a famous intellectual, atheist, libertarian, anti-war activist, many other things. And he wrote these lines that are almost sheer poetry. Three passions have governed my life: the longings for love, the search for knowledge, and unbearable pity for the suffering of humankind. Love brings ecstasy and relieves loneliness. In the union of love, I have seen, in a mystic miniature, the prefiguring vision of the heavens that saints and poets have imagined. With equal passion, I have sought knowledge. I have wished to understand the hearts of people. I have wished to know why the stars shine. Love and knowledge led upward to the heavens, but always pity brought me back to earth. Cries of pain reverberated in my heart, of children in famine, of victims tortured, and of old people left helpless. I long to alleviate the evil, but I cannot, and I too suffer. This has been my life. I found it worth living. Two other short comments were just too good to leave out, because they're on subjects no one ever mentions when you talk about the real miracles of life. George Bernard Shaw once wrote that perhaps the greatest social service that can be rendered by anybody to this country and to mankind is to bring up a family. And Bill Cosby said that for two people in a marriage to live together day after day is unquestionably the one miracle the Vatican has overlooked. Finally, a few words about the end of life, looking back, deciding whether it was worth it, and thoughts about death. First, the author W. Somerset Maugham's wonderful advice about death. Dying is a very dull, dreary affair, and my advice to you is to have nothing whatever to do with it. And then this kind of looking back. I was surprised I found it in these lists of proverbs. It's so musical, it almost wants to be sung. And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friends, I'll make it clear and state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I've traveled each and every highway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Those are the words of Paul Anka, written for Frank Sinatra. That's really not much different from Harriet Beecher Stowe's saying that the bitterest tears shed over graves are for words left unsaid and deeds left undone. Perhaps it's true, we hope it's true, that the truth which has made us free will in the end make us glad also. It does seem true that people living deeply have no fear of death. And the lovely thought that those who bring sunshine into the lives of others cannot keep it from themselves. We pray that's true. And the admonition from the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. can't be left out of a list like this. Thou shalt not be a victim. Thou shalt not be a perpetrator. Above all, thou shalt not be a bystander. Marion Wright Edelman, founder of the Children's Defense League, from whom I've taken several of these thoughts, adds another. She says, a lot of people are waiting for Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi to come back, but they're gone. We are it. It's up to us. It's up to you. But we can't end this with guilt or judgment. So I'll end it with the words, finally, of a theologian, the one who spent much of his career addressing secular listeners in secular language, like the language he uses here. His name was Reinhold Niebuhr. He was my teacher's teacher. Here's what he said. Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we are saved by hope. Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we are saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. And no virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our own. Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness. Forgiveness. The first really religious word in the whole sermon, and just in time.